Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is tape number 368. It's part four in the series on Guyana. It's December 22nd, and this is side one. There were several items in the news this week that may have skipped your attention, and I'd want to dwell on those particular articles with you because we don't want to lose sight of them. The first one was Friday, December the 8th, 1978. The lead article, Memo Discusses Smuggling Witness into Guyana. This is written by Nicholas Hurrock of the New York Times, and it has to do with a correspondence of Terry Buford, the woman closest to Jim Jones, who made the deposit of their money into banks in Zurich and Panama, England, France, and there's supposed to be 12 different bank accounts going into many, many millions, and this is the woman that is staying at Mark Lane's home right now. And it seems that she was discussing with Jim Jones through correspondence early in the year, moving Miss Walden, that's Miss Grace Stevens, from Memphis to Guyana in the custody of Jim Jones. I want to go into that and the implications of this with you. Also, there's another article that is interrelated. It's not separate, and it was in the various newspapers, but covered in three different ways, and I want to discuss that with you. And the lead article is Tennessee Parole Probe Not Over, because we're talking again about Tennessee. Grace Walden is in Tennessee. James Earl Ray is in Tennessee. And I want to go right into the story first of this investigation of the governor. He'll be out in January, Governor Ray Blanton, and then on to Grace Stevens, and then some more about Mark Lane. You now have my outline that was enclosed with the tape last week of the categories that I do my research under for the Guyana story. And the way I add new stories as they come are to put new numbers, as I explained before, under the various sections. And under Section 6, Conspiratorial Links, I now make a section called 67A, Martin Luther King Assassination, and 67B, Angola Mercenaries, because we'll go into that. And then under Cities and Countries, I forgot to put Panama and also Angola. Those are important countries, and I'll explain why later. But I want to tell you how I do add when I get new information. I add to these basic files, and they just keep growing. In 1977, when the House Select Committee started doing their work into the assassination of John Kennedy and Reverend Martin Luther King, there were a rash of deaths of very important witnesses that took place one after the other. In April, there was George de Morenschild and Charles Nicoletti, Carlos Prius Siqueiros. I talked about those on my tape, April 11, 1977. That was Dialogue Conspiracy number 264. And just as I mentioned last week, I had talked about the School for Assassins down in Guyana, August 15, 77. I also talked about the escape, the second escape of James Earl Ray. The first one was in St. Louis, Missouri, the first round before Martin Luther King was killed. But tape number 274, those of you who have it can play it over, and those of you who don't have it, I'll give a little more update and background on it. It was June the 20th, 1977, and I went into great length on about the fact that James Earl Ray was to be the primary witness before the House Select Committee, probably the two most important witnesses who could go before the committee in Washington, D.C., would be Grace Stevens and James Earl Ray. And I mentioned at the time that that escape that James Earl Ray did was a phony escape. It served a lot of purposes, and I think that he would have been allowed to leave, except that the House Committee was just under formation. They were just beginning to start, and they got outraged at the fact that James Earl Ray had escaped, particularly the Black Caucus. So that there was an article in the Washington Post, George Lardner said, Hill Assassination Unit to probe Ray's escape. And I said at the time that the only reason they brought him back was that there was too much pressure on the governor in Tennessee, that they intended to let him leave, but there was too much pressure. And the witnesses, as I say, in the John Kennedy assassination, Gary Powers, William Sullivan, George de Morenschild, the major witnesses were dying off like flies, and at that same time they were planning the escape. and hoping they could get away with it, of James Earl Ray. And then I'll show you through the New York Times article that they were also planning to get rid of Grace Stevens. As it turned out, they didn't use her before the House Select Committee, and they didn't even use James Earl Ray. He was told that he would come back and testify about where he had been and his expenses. And the House Select Committee took $6 million for their investigation and didn't call James Earl Ray or Grace Stevens, but there was a plan afoot to get rid of both of them, just as there was to get rid of these other major witnesses. I also did a tape, before I go on to these news articles, number 294, that was November the 6th, 1977, on Robert Watson. He was a witness to conversation about killing Martin Luther King that involved members of the John Birch Society and gun running and narcotics traffic and assassination team. And this also, this Georgia connection is very important to the Martin Luther King assassination and may have very important links down to the Guyana story, because Watson worked closely with Dick Gregory and Mark Lane, and Mark didn't use any of his material before the House Select Committee, the entire hearings. Robert Watson was in a federal prison on a narcotics rap, he said, was planted on him, and I got a Christmas card from him, he's out. But he had a lot of information that he was promised would be used by the House Select Committee, and they came to see him in the federal prison and took affidavits from him and information on the conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King and didn't use that information, and now he's out, and I'm sure that they'll never use any of his information, and he'll keep quiet because he's glad to be home. The Monterey Herald, our local paper here, had a story about the governor of Tennessee, and I'm going to compare the coverage for you between the Monterey Herald, the San Jose Mercury, and the San Francisco Chronicle, because I think it illustrates how the news is projected in each individual paper and how important it is for me doing my research to read 10 or 12 papers a day, the ones that I subscribe and then the clippings that are sent to me from friends around the country. In order to get a full picture, or even a fraction, I won't say I get a full picture, but a fraction, you have to take a cross-section of newspapers. The Monterey Herald had an Associated Press story. All of these came from the AP, so that means it was up to the desk to cut out what they wanted. The AP story, December 19th, 1978, has a lead story, Faces State Court Hearing Grand Jury Parole Selling Scandal, Meshes a Tennessee Governor. This has to do with Nashville, Tennessee Governor Ray Blanton, who didn't run for election this year. Of course, he's been under investigation for several years, and he's going out. He's a Democratic governor. And in January, he'll be out. But the grand jury, according to the Monterey Herald story, was investigating a parole-selling scandal that, in quotes, is scarring his final days of administration. Blanton was subpoenaed to appear with undisclosed office files following the arrest of his two top assistants, one by the name of Charles Benson, another, Mr. T. Edward Sisk. That's his legal counsel, or was. He's now hired James Neal, a former Watergate special prosecutor, as a legal counsel for Blanton. Of course, what else would it be? You have Leon Jaworski hiding the real Watergate stories of murders and assassinations and possible drug running of the CIA and smuggling of narcotics and weapons, along with these political assassination teams. And then here's James Neal, a special Watergate prosecutor, who's representing Mr. Ray Blanton, and I'm sure that Blanton knows so much that he'll just get a little slap on the wrist. Also charged in the same case, and this is the important name, is Lieutenant Charles Frederick Taylor, 40 years old, who's been 15 years on the Tennessee Highway Patrol. Taylor was suspended without pay and held for a $100,000 bond in Memphis, and the other two are out. The article says the bank accounts of Sisk and Benson and Taylor and others have been investigated by the CIA, and they were, by the FBI, not the CIA, I'm sorry, and there were marked bills, and money was deposited in their account. It said, Blanton said, in quotes, if his aides are convicted, it would be a great affront to the dignity of all Tennesseans. Now, that's the Associated Press story from the Monterey Herald, which doesn't really tell you much, except that the governor and his legal counsel and an assistant are involved and a highway patrolman by the name of Frederick Taylor are involved in a scandal there of receiving some money of selling paroles. The next article is from the San Jose Mercury, the lead story saying, Tennessee parole probe not over. It goes on to say, the evidence so far examined in the parole hearing arrest of three aides to Governor Ray Blanton may be, in quotes, only the tip of the iceberg, said the FBI officials. We heard that by Senator Howard Baker when the Watergate investigation was entirely over. The great investigators such as James Neal and Leon Jaworski, they told us as they closed the book, the tip of the iceberg, you only got the tip. The FBI said we have a long way to go. The federal agents have accused the aides of trading paroles, extraditions, and pardons for cash. So the same AP wire service by the San Jose Mercury goes into extraditions and pardons in it, as well as paroles. The three men were charged with conspiracy and extortion. It goes on to say how long the governor's office has been investigated. The federal complaint said that Benson had documents for the executive commutation of sentence of a man by the name of Larry Hacker, a convicted burglar. Hacker supposedly engineered the 1977 prison escape of James Earl Ray, convicted assassin of Reverend Martin Luther King. So that article goes a little further, and then we go back to June 20th, 1977 on Dialogue Conspiracy, and I was talking about that phony escape, and this article, a year and a half later, talks about Mr. Hacker engineering the escape of James Earl Ray, and then money going into the desk and offices of the attorney and the governor, and in return, they're going to let this man off on a parole. The San Francisco Chronicle has another article on the same subject but written differently, and its lead story is Tennessee Scandal. Parole selling probe is going full steam. And it says the governor of Tennessee accepted the resignation of two assistants who've been arrested on the federal charge of extortion conspiracy to sell paroles and for commutations and extraditions. The FBI complaint said that Charles Benson, who was the extradition officer for the governor of Tennessee, had legal papers bearing upon the early release of Larry Ed Hacker, reputed ringleader in the escape in 1977 from Brushy Mountain State Penitentiary with James Earl Ray. I got out my notebook and information that I had done on that phony escape and the radio show that I had done, the work that I had done for that particular episode, because this so-called escape was coming just at the time, as I say, when James Earl Ray would be called as a major witness. And I alluded to very famous possible escapes that seem historically to be accurate. New research coming out about John Wilkes Booth, Amelia Earhart, the actual murder of the Lindbergh baby, Lee Harvey Oswald, the Tsar and Tsarina, and the head of the Russian family and their children, and even Adolf Hitler. For some of you that are buying this tape or ordering it just for the Guyana series, I'm going into this because it precedes the next part of Guyana, and it explains possibly what Guyana was about. In addition to being a school for assassins and a place where mind control and experimentation could be done and various witnesses could be flown in or out, it raises the possibility, A, would they have flown James Earl Ray down there? Did they fly him out? The governor at the time said they thought he was in Nicaragua. He gave that as a speculation that he could be in Nicaragua. But was Guyana used for something else during the years before a large group of black people were brought down there for a front? I mentioned, this is June 20th, 1977, about the way that James Earl Ray, in quotes, escaped. And I said there was more to the story than they were telling. And one reason for this scene would be to have an excuse to move him from a state to a federal prison, which would be easier to handle. And I said that they had taken him out of the country but brought him back because there was too much attention paid to it and there would be a major investigation and that it was a dry run for another escape. They've promised him that he would be able to escape. And I went into the physical tactics of that so-called escape. The wires were cut that night. The voltage was off. The telephones were out of order for 15 minutes. There was a corner of the wall that he was supposed to go off. Nobody guarded it. The closest guard didn't shoot. He was reading a book. He was supposed to shoot if anyone was 10 feet away from the wall, and he was reading a book. There was a diversionary out in the yard where a man pretended he broke his foot. There was a false altercation. He went with six other people, and this is the interesting part. The emergency tower was unguarded, and I talked about his work in the laundry room and the man in the laundry room helping him escape, and about the prison intelligent network that allowed him to escape. The warden, or it was the warden at the time, that said he might be in Guatemala, and I thought that was interesting because Guyana isn't very far away from Panama or Guatemala, and People's Temple had members visiting Panama, making bank deposits and so forth. It could have flown him back or taken him, if he had escaped, right down to Guyana. And I mentioned a Edward Hacker who was arrested inside of a rural Baptist church. Edward Hacker. And I wondered if this church was a place for James Earl Ray to escape to and meet, because I mentioned that the people that killed Officer Tippett at the time that John Kennedy was murdered ran into a church and hid down the street in a church, and it was a safe place because nobody suspects a church, and churches make good getaway places. You don't go in with the bloodhounds looking for somebody in church. And I wondered how in the world Edward Hacker got inside the church. And I went into his background and speculated that Hacker had planned the organizing of the escape, that he worked in the plumbers unit. Remember, the White House plumbers, and the plumbing unit is a name for people that fix things. There was a man, plumber from Lockheed, St. Caesar, that has been accused of being killed. Researchers have said he's the one who killed Robert Kennedy, that Sirhan Sirhan did not do the fatal shot. And there are a lot of plumbers that are involved. The White House plumbers set up. That's a code name for a lot of assassinations and conspiracies. And I did mention that I believe that Mr. Hacker, who was in the church, had a part in the escape of James Earl Ray. That was in June 1977 that I was saying this. And now the complaint in this trial is that they were trying to get executive commutation for that same Larry Hacker that I was talking about, that convicted burglar, that it was indeed Larry Hacker who helped James Earl Ray escape, and that it seems that in return for letting them get out, these high-up officials in Tennessee were given money, and evidently they promised him that if he does this and helps him get out, that they'd be paid off, the officials would be paid off, and he'd be paid off by getting an early parole. I don't even think there was a trial. I think they were all put back in their cell, and nothing more was said about that crazy escape. But I think it was a dry run, and I think there were a lot of purposes that went into the last tape. And Mark Lane, being the attorney for James Earl Ray, and being the attorney for Grace Stevens, and also for the People's Temple, you have one plan where the highest officials of the state not only locked up Grace Stevens in a mental hospital, but they released her to Mark Lane, and they were being paid off to give parole to a man who had gotten out with James Earl Ray, and that included the governor's attorney and the highway patrolman who was involved. And the very person that I named in 77 who assisted in this was being paid off with his early parole. Of course, the old CIA writers were out lauding James Earl Ray's great escape and saying it couldn't possibly be a conspiracy. These pathological liars who get these huge books and legal fees are so disgusting. June 12, 1977, there was an article in the San Francisco Examiner Chronicle, and William Bradford Huey, of course, saying there was no conspiracy. The article says escape or an abduction by conspirators, and Huey was saying, why, there was no conspiracy for Ray. I always told you he was going to escape. He's the only person. There never was a conspiracy. Then George McMillan, the author of The Making of an Assassin, the story of James Earl Ray, says, that's damn nonsense to say that Ray had outside help in the escape. He did it alone. I always told you he could do it. And then Percy Foreman, the attorney, who had represented James Earl Ray, who told him to plead guilty the first time, said, rejected suggestions that this escape was part of a widespread conspiracy to help or to destroy him. He said that he just took advantage of plans of five other prisoners and that conspiracies are theories as fiction and it's all a bunch of lies. He said it's consistent with all the other lies that have been printed about Ray. It makes beautiful writing to say, oh, H.L. Hunt probably came back to life and helped him out. But he said, I won't spend my time analyzing the manure. And Julian Bond of Atlanta said, Ray's escape is terrifying. A madman is on the loose. So there's William Bradford, Huey George McMillan, Percy Forman, and Julian Bond, and they're all a bunch of liars because it's perfectly obvious now that the highest echelons of the government of Tennessee were paying off people and being paid for assisting James Earl Ray's escape at that time. The same cast of characters keeps coming through the last 10, 15 years as McMillan and his sister Priscilla Johnson and Percy Forman and Huey. It's so sickening to see their names in the news, and of course they just repeat their lies every time the press interviews them, they have to repeat another lie. And now to the second big article, which is separate but not unrelated, because this again involves a primary witness in the Martin Luther King assassination, such an important witness that she was in the rooming house. This Grace Stevens was in the rooming house when James Earl Ray was supposed to have left the rooming house. He says he checked in, left a gun in the room that he was told to purchase. He had a few toilet articles and a radio that he had taken out of the St. Louis, Missouri prison that would identify him as having been in that room. And he claims that he was in a car that Raul had given him money to buy and that he wasn't in the rooming house when Martin Luther King was killed. A gun went off, and there's no identification by the FBI or police to this day that that gun was the fatal gun that killed Martin Luther King. But a man was in the rooming house, in the bathroom. He wrapped up the items that were in James Earl Ray's room, left them at the door. And there was a woman, Grace Stevens, whose husband was supposed to have seen the man leave the building. And the FBI wanted to use him as a witness that it was James Earl Ray. And she had claimed that she saw somebody leave who was much smaller and different in size than James Earl Ray. When he was picked up in London and she saw the picture, she said, oh, no, that's not him. But right after the killing of Martin Luther King, several days later, the police came in Memphis, Tennessee, and took Grace Stevens to a mental hospital, and then within a very short period transferred her to another hospital where she stayed for 8 years. She goes by the name Grace Walden, and also the common law husband she had was Stevens, so she's known as Grace Walden and Grace Stevens. And as of April 28th of this year in 1978, Grace Walden Stevens was still in the Tennessee State Prison Hospital. And I'm going into her story now, but I want to get to that New York Times article, and I think I should read it to you as much as I can on this tape and maybe copy it and give you a printed sheet with it. I think that would be a good idea. Memorandum found in the files of Jim Jones, apparently written by official of the People's Temple, discussed the possibility of Mark Lane smuggling a witness in the Martin Luther King assassination case into Guyana using a false passport. The memo was discovered among papers dated early this year, apparently written by Terry Buford, saying confidential, confidential, and addressed to Jim Jones. And quote, I got a message over here that you want me to tell Mark Lane that he should look into some alternative means of getting Grace Walden to Guyana before the CIA might try to stop her from entering the country. Therefore, Mark should try to get her another passport. Now, just stopping right there, the implications are tremendous because Terry Buford claims that she only went to Mark Lane 3 weeks before Congressman Leah Ryan went down to Guyana. And Lane claims that he only became counsel and learned of Jim Jones in September, or I guess the end of September. He went down to Guyana. He had a press conference in October, so it must have been in September. But this memo is dated the first of the year, early this year. I called Nicholas Hart. He didn't call back at the New York Times. I tried to get the data on this memo. It goes on to say, Miss Walden, a Memphis resident with a history of mental illness, has been put forth by Mr. Lane as a witness who could prove that James Earl Ray did not shoot Dr. King. Investigations by several organizations, including the House of Representatives, have found her testimony useless. But according to the memo, Mr. Lane persuaded members of the Temple that the U.S. authorities wanted to silence Miss Walden. I will relay the message to Mark and see what he says, the memo said. I will do so in person, as I don't feel it is wise to do this over the phone. So the question here, of course, is, did Terry Buford get in touch with Mark Lane early in the year prior to when Grace Stevens was released from the mental hospital? Because if she did, then the collusion of the judge in Memphis, Tennessee, or even the governor, again, the same man that's involved with that escape attempt of James Earl Ray, the highest officials in the state of Memphis, Tennessee, may have been arranging for Grace to be removed from the scene just as they were arranging for James Earl Ray to be removed, because she was a primary witness. And Lane said she was an important witness who could prove that James Earl Ray was not in the rooming house, and yet he didn't insist that she come up and testify before the House Select Committee. Lane also took James Earl Ray and put him on Jack Anderson's show, where he had a polygraph test, and Anderson said James is a liar. That's what his attorney did. His attorney got him publicly to be exposed as a liar before the hearings, and never got James Earl Ray before the House Select Committee. And he never did anything to get Grace Stevens, even though he keeps blaming the CIA for these conspiracies. He kept Grace Stevens away from that committee. The memo said if he doesn't have those kind of contacts to send her down there, do you think we might offer the tampering of Maxine Swaney's passport? We have her passport here, that's evidently in San Francisco, and it might be something that would be similar to Grace Walden. And also, if it doesn't look like her, maybe we'll swap the picture. The drawback of this would be, of course, if a traitor were to look at the immigration list, we would be caught in a minute. The good point of this would be we wouldn't run the risk of getting caught by a passport on the white market. The memo signed Terry has surfaced at a time, according to the New York Times, when more and more questions are being asked about Mark Lane's dealings with the People's Temple and the United States government on behalf of the cult. American officials spoke privately today of a letter from the lawyer Mark Lane to the State Department warning that if it didn't halt the harassment of the cult, they'd have to embarrass the United States. They'd move and embarrass the United States. And then Mr. Lane had sent a letter to Congressman Leo Ryan of that effect, telling him, threatening, don't mess around with Jim Jones. Mr. Lane didn't mention the country by name, but they thought maybe it was the Soviet Union or Cuba, and Lane would be trying to embarrass the United States government. The New York Times goes on to say that Mr. Lane often appeared as the person who was feeding the paranoia into Jim Jones in Jonestown. In a news conference on September the 20th, he said that there were massive conspiracies to destroy the People's Temple and a massive conspiracy to destroy Jim Jones initiated by the intelligence of the United States. Lane has a lawyer down in Memphis, Tennessee with him, a law associate. I don't know if she's a lawyer, by the name of April Ferguson. And in the New York Times, it said Ms. Ferguson said that there had been discussion about taking Ms. Walden there, but there was no reason she could not have traveled openly. Well, the question is, of course, where is Grace Walden now? Because all of the time of the hearing of the House Select Committee, we never saw a view of her or a picture of her with Mark Lane like we have of Terry Buford. And, of course, the open question is she down there in Memphis, Tennessee, or was she substituted for Maxine Swaney? It would be interesting for the State Department. I've called them to see if they found a Maxine Swaney down in Guyana who was dead, but her passport was in the United States, and she's as good as a dead woman. If you give her passport to somebody else, that means that she never, never can return home. And because there's still 200 people missing and unidentified out of the 1,200 in Guyana. It would be interesting to know if any one of them was Maxine Swaney, who was killed so that Grace could use her passport, or if Grace Stevens is alive, and also the date early this year, because Miss Ferguson said they had discussed taking Miss Walden there. But if they discussed it early in the year, then Mark Lane is lying about the dates that he started to meet Terry Buford, and he's lying about the date that he started working for Jim Jones, or that Jones was interested in his case. And why in the world would Jim Jones be wanting to help Mark Lane get this woman, Grace Walden, down to Guyana? He had a saying, anyone who goes down there has no way out. And if she was a primary witness, Lane accused the CIA of trying to hamper her testifying before the committee, but she was a primary witness, and he was trying to get her out of this country and out of planet Earth forever by sending her down there. That wasn't protection, and yet her own attorney was instrumental in these shenanigans. On November 4, 1978, Duncan Ragsdale from Memphis, Tennessee, an attorney, was assigned as co-conservator for Grace Stevens. I'll do more about Grace Stevens on the other side of this tape, and some more about Mark Lane and Guyana, the tragedy known as Guyana.